The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Endocrine pancreas, diabetes mellitus, metabolic syndrome is presented by Dr. Jack Snitzer.
So the endocrine, related to endocrine pancreas, nothing about the exocrine pancreas will be mentioned here. Alpha cells, glucagon, beta cells, insulin, delta cells, somatostatin. D1 cells are vasoactive intestinal polypeptide, F cells, pancreatic polypeptide, and G cells are gastrin. Glucagonoma, this is not something anyone really needs to know, causes increased glucose production, rare, often malignant tumors. The only reason I mention it is because of this classic necrolytic migratory erythema, which is a classic rash. Every now and then you see that on various places because that's just so pathognomonic for glucagonoma. You can have painful glossitis, which is something that is often we associate with glucagonoma, and you need to know. Angular stomatitis, surgery is the main treatment. Octreotide can palliate. Insulinoma, now this is probably the most overdiagnosed or overconsidered disease in almost all of endocrine, because insulinomas are very, very common. If somebody has hypoglycemia that's very severe, often spontaneous, you really have to check them for insulinoma. If they're dizzy, woozy, and they say, oh, I think I have to eat, my blood sugar feels like it's low, chances are they don't have an insulinoma, but we get workups for them all the time. We probably should, but that's not where we see it usually. So spontaneous hypoglycemia, 80% are benign, usually very small tumors. Second most common pancreatic tumor found in MEN1. The diagnosis is an elevated insulin and C-peptide level with simultaneously low glucose and symptoms. So it's a lot of people, especially women, have low blood sugars multiple times throughout the day without symptoms, and that's not considered abnormal. Fasting glucose less than 50, surgery for this is the main treatment. And octreotide can palliate, but they really need surgery. They won't see this on a CAT scan. They won't see this on an MRI of the pancreas. They might see it on an intraoperative ultrasound, but you really need a surgeon who's very comfortable with this type of surgery. Other causes in non-diabetics, and again, diabetics, the most common cause is medications. But reactive hypoglycemia, generally in obese patients with metabolic syndrome, they just have insulin resistance syndrome. They may have an over-exuberant insulin response to carbs. Their treatment is don't eat a lot of carbs and avoid simple sugars and maybe small frequent meals. Malnutrition, celiac disease, eating disorder, alcoholism can cause hypoglycemia from decreased stores of hepatic glucose. Cortisol insufficiency, adrenal or pituitary cause. In my practice, the most common thing I see when somebody has truly significant hypoglycemia and they're not on a sulfonylurea or insulin or they're not diabetic is adrenal or pituitary insufficiency. Nasidioblastosis, for instance, post-gastric bypass, islet cell hyperplasia. It's also called nasidioblastosis. Hypoglycemia in non-diabetics, still going to this list, is liver disease from decreased stores of glucose, decreased gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis, surreptitious, malicious, or inadvertent use of insulin secretagogues or insulin. This is fairly high on my list. I've seen several cases of nursing homes. I'm hoping inadvertently giving someone a sulfonylurea or insulin. In this case, when the blood sugar is low, the insulin level will be very high, but the C-peptide level will be low. need to obtain these levels before treating with glucose or glucagon. The problem in the hospital setting or at home is that these people are given glucose or they eat before they go to the lab to get their blood test, and then that makes all the levels much higher. Or glucometer errors. Glucose meters are inaccurate when the blood sugar is low in general. We've had three cases at our hospital recently of patients who were in the critical care unit or in the step-down unit who had hypoperfusion of their fingers, weren't getting blood in their fingers. And they were being treated. Their finger sticks were always in the 30s and 40s, and most of them were without symptoms. And they were being treated. And finally, when we just said, hey, do a finger stick in the forearm, the blood sugar was 80 or 90, or when we did a venous blood sugar. But we tend to go into panic mode when the blood sugar is low on a finger stick and just treat the number. Think about it. Hypoperfusion, you're probably missing, if you work in the hospital, you're probably missing many cases. Remember, early hypoglycemia symptoms, shakes, sweats, anxiety, and hunger are due to catecholamine release. Conditions that can mimic hypoglycemia, but no consistent proof of low blood sugar at the time of the symptom. So in other words, if somebody comes to you saying, I feel like I have hypoglycemia, they might just be having catecholamine release symptoms. You know, shake, sweat. I get it when I'm hungry. If I haven't eaten for a day, I get shake, sweats, anxiety, hunger. And I don't have just like you all, I don't have the luxury of eating at that time. So eventually it goes away. If you can tough it out, you either feel bad for an hour or two and eat something, or you just feel bad for a while and then hope it gets better, and usually it gets better. But conditions that can mimic hypoglycemia with these terrible catecholamine symptoms, but no evidence of low blood sugar, neurologically mediated hypotension, that's probably number one on my list. Do a tilt table test on these patients, and a good percentage of them actually have hypotension, not hypoglycemia. POTS can do it. Seizures can do it. I had one person who had a delay in getting to me of about 6 months and for hypoglycemia, and about 2 days before she was going to have a consult with me, was hospitalized with a seizure. Turned out seizures were her problem. She wasn't getting hypoglycemic. Panic attacks, anxiety attacks, cardiac arrhythmia needs to be ruled out. Hunger itself, mastocytosis needs to be ruled out. Monoclonal gammopathy, medication side effect, pheochromocytoma, etc. In the endocrine world, we call this spells. If you ever heard an endocrinologist give a talk about spells, really interesting topic, but they cover a lot of these things on this list. Somatostatinoma, you don't need to know this, it's rare. Somatostatin inhibits the release of many substances, no specific syndrome, often malignant, so the treatment's surgery. VIPoma, vasoactive intestinal peptide secretion, severe watery diarrhea, rare, often malignant, they have to have surgery. Pancreatic polypeptide, this is sort of in the future, we're going to do something with pancreatic polypeptide. It inhibits gallbladder contraction and pancreatic enzyme secretion. No syndrome or symptoms. Might be a marker for tumors, pancreatic tumors in the future. Gastrinoma is something you should all know. Gastrin stimulates gastric acid secretion, most common pancreatic tumor associated with MEN1. ZE, Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, is peptic ulcer disease, increased gastric acidity. Secretin test to confirm the diagnosis. Octreotide scan can be used to define this, can be malignant. Treatment is either surgery or proton pump inhibitors can sometimes palliate enough that you don't need to do surgery, assuming it's not malignant. I had my first case of this. It was actually somebody else's case and a patient of mine a couple weeks ago. Now, to talk about diabetes, it's from Latin, diabetes, urine, it's paraphrasing, and mellitus is honey sweet. The main purpose of insulin, I tell all my patients, is aiding in the conversion of energy for intracellular, of carbohydrate into energy for intracellular energy. It is an anabolic hormone with salt retention properties. So I want my patients to know that insulin turns sugar into energy. Its primary function of insulin is not to lower the sugar. That's a byproduct. Normal blood sugar levels, fasting less than 100, 2 hour post-challenge or postprandial less than 140, A1C 5.5% or less. The diagnosis is a fasting blood sugar 126 or higher, which is 7 millimoles per liter in SI units. Fasting is defined as no caloric intake for at least 8 hours. Result may need to be confirmed by repeat testing. Or a 2-hour plasma glucose of 200 or higher, which is 11.1 millimoles per liter, and make sure that some patients still have the glucometers that read in millimoles. So you make sure that if they keep telling you their blood sugar is 111 or something like that, I've had some people, I say it's 111, it's actually 11.1 millimoles, but they just ignore the decimal point because there shouldn't be any decimal point. So every now and then you have to check the meter for the right settings. During a new oral glucose challenge should be under 200, or under 2 hour plasma glucose over 200 is diagnosis of diabetes in the challenge. Tests should be performed by, as described by WHO, using a glucose load containing the equivalent of 75 grams of anhydrous glucose dissolved in water. In a patient with classic symptoms of hyperglycemia or hyperglycemic crisis, a random plasma glucose of 200 or higher is probably a diagnosis, or an A1C of 6.5%. But I always give a warning, if you never get an A1C and just get an A1C, you might not catch diabetes early. You gotta get the A1C regularly to see when it finally crosses into pre-diabetic or diabetic range. It might be a trick to get insurance to pay for the A1C with certain diagnoses. They won't pay for it for pre-diagnosis, or for pre-diabetes. They'll pay for it for hyperglycemia, though, Medicare. Pre-diabetes is fasting hyperglycemia, blood sugar 100 to 125, two-hour post-challenge 140 to 199, or an A1C of 5.6 to 6.4. Okay. The complications, we all know this, fatigue, infections, blindness due to retinopathy, macular edema, things like that, atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease, nephropathy leading to renal failure, proteinuria, microalbuminuria, macroalbuminuria, it's a leading cause of adult renal failure, peripheral neuropathy, peripheral and autonomic neuropathy, erectile dysfunction, which is a type of autonomic neuropathy. Microalbuminuria is described as 30 to 300 micrograms per milligram. Macroalbuminuria is over 300 micrograms per milligram. I mentioned this later on. If you use LabCorp as your lab and some other labs, make sure it says micrograms per milligram, because if it doesn't say micrograms per milligram, you're not getting the microalbumin ratio and you're getting an incomplete test that's useless. So I have a lot of consults from patients who are doing well. The family doctor sends them to me because they have a microalbumin abnormality now of 300. Maybe 80 or something. But it turns out that the microalbumin ratio was not done, just the microalbumin. So when you do the ratio, have it done again the right way, it turns out they have no problems. So make sure the micrograms per milligram or milligram, or micro, it should say micrograms per, yeah, micrograms per milligram, that's right, or milligrams per gram. Type 1 diabetes is autoimmune attack on the islet cells, ketosis-prone diabetes, we sometimes think of it. Often GAD and 65 antibody positivity, that's glutamic acid decarboxylase. That's what we used to call islet cell antibodies. This is a more purified extract. And also insulin antibodies might be positive. In fact, insulin antibodies might go up earlier, but you don't have to have insulin antibody positivity. The treatment, obviously, for type 1 diabetes, which we don't call juvenile diabetes anymore because you can be any age and to get it, and a juvenile can become an adult, and so just call it type 1. Insulin, 2, 3, 4 times a day, multiple daily injections is MDI. Mealtime rapid-acting insulin for carbs plus high glucose correction dose of rapid-acting insulin. We try not to just use a sliding scale, of course, because that's only playing catch-up. We want something, a baseline dose for food, and then a coverage on top of that for high sugars, which we'll talk about more. Plus basal insulin to counteract the hepatic production of glucose. I'll talk about this 10 more times in this lecture. The function of basal insulin, 24-hour insulin, the main function is to give you enough insulin every second of every day to tell your liver to make the right amount of sugar. So it counteracts the hepatic production of glucose, turns the hepatic glucose into energy. Or the insulin pump. The DCCT, Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, this showed that tight glycemic control in patients with type 1 diabetes can reduce complications as much as 70%. This effect is long-lived, a legacy effect. In the old days, we used to say, oh, anytime you can do bad now with your diabetes, just improve it, you'll do fine in the future. Now we know that if you do bad for a period of time, that effect on increase in the risk of complications will be long-lived. 20 years later, you'll have a higher risk of complications because you did badly 20 years earlier. NPH insulin, one of the main reasons I would use this is for cost. I try not to use this if somebody can afford the more consistent basal insulins. This is human insulin. It's intermediate acting, relatively inexpensive, but it peaks and troughs. It peaks in 8 to 10 hours, and then it troughs. It gets out of the system maybe in 12, 14, maybe 16 hours. Basal insulin, there are more and more, and there's different variations. There's gimmicks. There's a whole bunch of things. There's glargine, which is Lantus, Detemir, which is Levemir, Toujeo, which is glargine U300, which has different properties. When you concentrate it, make it three times concentrated, it actually lasts longer than Lantus does. And Traceba, which is Degludec, which is U200 insulin. These are basically basal peakless insulins. They're called analog insulins. They're variations of human insulin, some amino acid switches. They take them once or twice daily. The last two, Toujeo and Traceba, are once daily. The first two are once or twice daily. Should be titrated to maintain a stable blood sugar overnight. Fasting blood sugar should roughly equal the prior night's bedtime blood sugar, assuming no food or rapid-acting insulin bedtime. So the purpose of basal insulin isn't to make the sugars low or normal or to drop the blood sugar. That's rapid-acting insulin that does that. The purpose of basal insulin is to keep the blood sugar stable in the fasting state. So I'll come back to this later, but if you go to bed with a sugar of 300, if you're on the right dose of basal insulin, you should wake up with 300. If you want to come down overnight, then you would take a little bit of rapid-acting insulin at bedtime to bring your sugar down, you know, cautiously. So we'll talk about that later. These are one of the they're the simplest, but some of the most complex and misused insulins in the world because we use them simplistically so a patient doesn't have to be on multiple doses of insulin. But unfortunately, you can give them a million units of basal insulin. Basal insulin doesn't fight food. So if a patient is significantly insulin deficient, they need something to fight food. You can't just raise basal insulin. Okay, the rapid-acting insulins, Humulin R, which is regular, longer-acting and later peak than rapid-acting insulin analogs. Function is to prevent carbohydrate intake from raising the blood sugar level and to treat elevated blood sugars. Relatively inexpensive, the only insulin used intravenously. There's no reason to use analog insulins intravenously, ever. Rapid-acting insulin analogs include Lispro, which is Humalog, Aspart, which is Novolog, and Glulysine, which is Apidra. Very similar. They all work about the same in most people. Relatively expensive. Onset more rapid than regular insulin. Effect is gone sooner than regular insulin, too, so it's not as long-lived. It basically matches food carbohydrates better than regular does most of the time. So just some things to think about with type 2 diabetes. Insulin resistance caused by genetics and abdominal obesity, adipokine dysfunction. In 5-10 years from now, the whole talk will be about adipocytokines, the hormones that come from fat cells. That's how we're going to treat diabetes probably in the future. Hyperinsulinemia years before diagnosis, this Harran syndrome, hyperandrogenism, insulin resistance, acanthosis nigricans, polycystic ovarian syndrome, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance syndrome. So here's just another way of looking at metabolic syndrome. You can have these things, insulin resistance, low HDL, small dense LDL, elevated uric acid, and ovulation, possibly PCOS. Here's the ATP3 classification of metabolic syndrome, three of these things. Abdominal obesity with a waist circumference, men greater than 40 inches, women greater than 35. Triglycerides, 150 or higher, HDL in men less than 40, women less than 50. Blood pressure 130 over 85 or higher, or fasting blood sugar 110 or higher. That 110 is kind of a made-up number based on some European data. This is acanthosis nigricans, which is the finding that's most pathognomonic for insulin resistance. Here's an ominous octet in type 2 diabetes by DeFranzo. You have decreased incretin effect starting at the top. You have increased lipolysis, which will be something in the future when we have better medications to treat. Increased glucose reabsorption, we have the SGLT2 agonist to work on that. Decreased glucose uptake in the muscle, neurotransmitter dysfunction, increased hepatic glucose production, increased glucagon secretion, and decrease insulin secretion, of course. And here's a natural history of type 2 diabetes. Basically what this shows is that when you start losing insulin production at least 10 years before you become diabetic. So the horse is out of the barn by the time you've burned out 50 to 75% of your pancreas by the time you're diagnosed. Now you're insulin resistant all the time. From the moment you have the genes and you're overweight, you're insulin resistant, and that stays the whole time unless you lose weight and or exercise. But the insulin deficiency gets worse and worse. That red line there shows that you're making less and less and less insulin, and until we call you a burned out type 2 diabetic who makes very little insulin. In my practice, I differentiate a couple things. One is I like to look at the patient, say, think to myself, is this patient severely insulin deficient or not? And I also look at patients. There's three types of diabetics in my practice, and they all behave differently and different medicines work. There's a class of patients whose fasting sugars are the highest of the day. They're the easiest to treat. The rest of the day, they're good. Fasting is the highest. Then there's a group of diabetics whose sugars are highest post-meal. They're next easiest to treat or next hardest to treat. Then you have patients whose sugars are high all day long, and they're the hardest to treat. And I like to classify my patients. Each patient I look at, and I get a mental picture of those things. Now, these are some diabetes studies. United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, UKPDS, showed reduced microvascular complications in type 2 diabetics with tighter control. Macrovascular complications were lower, but not significantly. There was a legacy effect, just like the DCCT in type 1 diabetics. This showed a legacy effect in type 2 diabetics of bad blood sugar control can beget complications later on. There's a diabetes prevention program. Exercise and metformin delayed development of type 2 diabetes from pre-diabetes. I quote this a lot to my patients. Exercise actually did better than metformin. So these are just some concepts, FYI. I mentioned in the second last one there, cytokines and adipocytokines like adiponectin, leptin, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor. Those are all inflammatory or anti-inflammatory chemicals that come from the fat cells. Remember, fat cells are not just for storage of fat. They're endocrine glands. They secrete adipocytokines. And when somebody asks, one of my patients asked me, why can't I lose weight? It must be my thyroid. I say, it's probably, if you're well-treated or you don't have thyroid disease, probably not your thyroid. In the future, this is what we're going to find it's going to be, the adipocytokine dysfunction, where you make too much resistant, for instance, or too much ghrelin, which are bad for your metabolism, and not enough adiponectin or leptin. But that's in the future because we don't have treatment and we don't have really good diagnostic procedures for that. Type 2 diabetes medicines by guanides, including the only one, metformin. This was approved, I was just reading this morning also, this was approved in Europe in 1957, and 35 years later, they approved metformin in the United States to be for general public use. Metformin decreases hepatic glucose production, side effects lactic acidosis, which is exceedingly rare. It's so rare that they published a case of it in the New England Journal a year and a half ago. B12 deficiency, don't forget B12 deficiency. I found that in some patients, especially on high-dose metformin, if they have neuropathy that doesn't seem to improve when their blood sugar is good, supplementing them with B12 helps because of some subtle B12 deficiency due to metformin. GI upset, diarrhea. The GI upset and diarrhea are the most problematic. I find that the metformin extended release causes less diarrhea, and also lowering the dose causes less diarrhea. Contraindicated if creatinine is 1.4 or higher, this is initiation of metformin, and that's in the female, or 1.5 or higher in males, or if significant hepatic dysfunction, or if the patient's in CHF. That has changed, and I have it a little later on about the change. Might decrease risk of some cancers. That's being looked at. It's not going to be a board question, and if it is, you'd say there's no evidence that it does that, but there are some docs who are convinced it does. Delays conversion of prediabetes into diabetes. We know that. This is a new guideline for maintaining metformin in people who are already on it. You can start metformin, first of all, if the GFR is greater than 45, can continue metformin if the GFR is 30 or higher, stop metformin if the GFR is under 30. It's the first drug to use in a patient with type 2 diabetes if there's no contraindications. This is a question that I would put on every test I ever took, because you just need to know that this is the first drug that a person should be on for type 2 diabetic should be on. So you'd use it at the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. You don't wait that 3 months or 6 months like we did in the old days. At diagnosis of diabetes, you tell your patient they're going to be starting this agent if there's no contraindications. Now, sulfonylureas are getting a little passe, but we're using them still frequently. I use them frequently. They're cheap. They work. Sometimes they're one thing we can do to keep somebody off insulin because they're on other agents. But they're insulin secretagogues, glipizide, glimepiride. I should put a big X through glyburide. Even Medicare has woken up and realized you shouldn't use glyburide anymore because of some cardiovascular data that is bad that might be associated with glyburide particularly and not the other two. Stimulate insulin production, again, avoid glyburide. The way Medicare works, of course, is 3 years ago, they made us use glyburide, and then starting about 2 years ago, they send you a nasty letter if you have a patient on glyburide. So main side effects, hypoglycemia. Patients always talk about the side effects of these drugs they see on TV. All these side effects, pancreatic cancer, thyroid cancer on these, GLP-1 agonists. But they forget, this one has one main side effect, and it's hypoglycemia, which has more morbidity and mortality than all the other drugs combined. So this is a very severe side effect, hypoglycemia. More hospital admissions, dollars spent, et cetera, on this. Black box warning, increased cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, possibly just glyburide, but they all contain this black box warning. Alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, good drugs, but they're expensive. They have to be taken at least two, probably three times a day. Acarbose, which is precoce, or amiglitol, which is Glycet, they delay absorption of carbohydrates. Side effects are gas. I always joke that, and I come from Salisbury, Maryland, where there's a lot of watermen catching crabs. The only people I have on these agents are watermen because they can have as much gas as they need to or want to when they're out on their boat by themselves. So type 2 diabetes medications, TZDs, there's still both of them, Actos and Avandia, pioglitazone and rosiglitazone. Avandia has come back. Some of the bad things have actually been found not to be true about it, increased cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, except CHF warning. This can cause fluid retention. And they improve insulin resistance. These are PPAR gamma receptor agonists. Side effects, edema, CHF, weight gain, worsened bone density. Actos. There was this small risk of urinary bladder cancers, but recent studies say doesn't seem to be the case. But Actos still has to have that in their PI. They contraindicated an NYHA class 3 or 4 CHF. And I shouldn't have spelled that out. I always tell my nurse practitioner, stop spelling at me. That's New York Heart Association class 3 and 4 CHF. Type 2 medications, miglitinides, repaglinide, prandin, nateglinide, Estarlix. They stimulate postprandial insulin secretion, just like sulfonylureas, but they're briefer. They're good agents, but the bad side effect is low blood sugars. DPP-4 inhibitors, you have Januvia, sitagliptin, Onglyza, saxagliptin, linagliptin, which is Tradjenta, and allogliptin, which is Nucina, all about the same. They have subtle issues with each one. That if you read about them, they'll just have different things, slightly different PI warnings, but they work generally about the same. With Tradjenta, there's no reduced dose for renal insufficiency. The other ones, the doses are reduced, I believe. They increase GLP-1 and GIP levels, so you get insulin production on demand. Suppress inappropriate postprandial glucagon production, too. So they do two things on demand. So they basically, the function turns off when you don't need them. So very kind of like smart pills. Precautions, possibly pancreatitis. Pancreatic cancer, recent studies have said no. There's an increased risk of hospitalization for CHF in some studies. Januvia was a classic one for this. Not sure if true or if it's a class effect. GLP-1 agonists given sub-Q, exenatide, which is Byetta, twice daily, liraglutide, which is Victoza, once daily, Bydureon, extended-release exenatide, which is once weekly, Trulicity, which is dulaglutide, once weekly, and Tanzium, albiglutide, once weekly. The effects increase secretion on demand of insulin, suppresses postprandial glucagon production. They do what DPP-4 inhibitors do, but they do it in spades. And so because they're stronger, they suppress the appetite and cause early satiety and weight loss. Victoza in a higher dose, it's called something else, Saxenda, is improved for weight reduction. Side effects are nausea, vomiting, pancreatitis, possibly, again, questionably medullary thyroid cancer in animals at least, and questionably pancreatic cancer. Recent study called LEADER showed Victoza decreased cardiovascular mortality in a primary prevention study. SGLT2 inhibitor, Invokana, Farxiga, Jardiance, Canna, we call them Canna, DAPA, and EMPA. The mechanism of action, increased urinary excretion of glucose, side effects, dehydration, vaginal or penile yeast infections, urinary infections. You will see these too. Warn these people ahead of time so they call you when it happens, because a lot of them have good experiences despite this, as long as they know they need to get treatment if these occur. Hyperkalemia and Invokana, and Farxiga has a bladder cancer warning in its PI. Don't know if that's true or not. Jardiance had a recent study called EMPA-RAG Outcome, shows a decrease in cardiovascular mortality in patients with cardiovascular disease, and this was a secondary prevention study. So there's all kinds of different ways you can use this, combination therapy. You can use amylin in type 2 diabetics. I won't go into that. Insulin, intensive insulin, and insulin pumps. Now, in type 1 diabetics, it's insulin one way or the other. And intensive insulin therapy is what endocrinologists tend to do when we have a compliant enough patient or family help. Insulin pump therapy, I'll skip amylin. So we talked about the basal insulins, rapid-acting insulins. Don't forget there's U500 insulin out there, and you'll see it more and more because it's being promoted. It now comes as a pen that's U500, so you don't have to make the mental conversion of how much insulin they're taking. And they now make U500 syringes. So if you're on U500 insulin, you should be on U500 syringes with that, so you don't have to do the mental math that they're getting five times more than what the U100 syringe says. So just give them U500 syringes, and the amount they dial up is the amount they're getting. We talked about this, pre-mixed insulins, relatively simplistic insulins. If a person can't or won't do better, I'll have them on pre-mixed insulin. U500, as I mentioned, is five times concentrated, and it changes its whole pharmacokinetic profile by concentrating it. It almost becomes like intermediate acting insulin when you concentrate the U500. Inhaled insulin, Afrezza, not overly used by patients. You got to get breathing tests initially, then every 6 months for the first year, and then yearly. But there is an inhaled insulin that it comes in this delivery device. Intensive insulin therapy, I just want to talk about or show you this is just stuff for background information. Basal bolus therapy, you'll hear basal bolus therapy a lot. That's when you have somebody on multiple shots or an insulin pump. Basal means the amount they're getting all day long, the little bit they're getting all day long. Bolus means the amount they're getting for food. Okay, this is just background so you can have it. ADA recommendations, this is important for practice. Yearly dilated eye exam, evaluate feet at each visit, check sensation in the feet with a 10-gram nylon monofilament. Dental exams, A1C 2 to 4 times yearly. Urine microalbumin ratio, I even put the LabCorp code. If you write microalbumin ratio, LabCorp will do it wrong because alphabetically microalbumin without the ratio is first. So use that code. Aspirin use if not contraindicated, ACE inhibitor or ARB, especially if microalbuminuria or if hypertensive. There's some pushback periodically about whether everybody needs to be on an ACE or ARB. Goals of therapy, 6.5% or better if you can achieve this safely. This is an ACE goal. Less tight control in the young, elderly, and those with hypoglycemia unawareness and marked comorbidities. ADA goal is less than 7% if you can achieve this safely. This is just some background information on consensus algorithms, what to start with, what to do next. Basically, they say you start with metformin, add DPP-4 inhibitors every month or two or three, DPP-4 inhibitor, a GLP-1 agonist, SGL-2 inhibitors. This is a basic way we're doing it. Diabetes variants, MODY, which is maturity onset diabetes of the young. We think this is actually more common than we give it credit for. It's monogenic diabetes. This is one gene mutation. There's seven or eight MODYs right now. One of them actually is very responsive to sulfonylureas after poo-pooing sulfonylureas. But there's no great test right now. There's a couple labs in the country that do testing for this, but it's not cost effective, and who do you get tests on? Then there's LADA, which is latent autoimmune diabetes of adults. This is just type 1 diabetes in adults. You can get type 1 diabetes at any age. You know, you can be 70 years old, get type 1 diabetes, just an autoimmune disease happens to flare up. Drugs causing secondary diabetes, glucocorticoids, atypical antipsychotics, statins, pentamidine, thiazides, birth control pills, Dilantin, HIV drugs. Alcohol can cause secondary diabetes, pancreatic disease from alcohol or pancreatic disease from other things. Cushing's, hemochromatosis, lipodystrophy disorders. These are just some trials for background. Let's go to the ACCORD. The ACCORD study showed that initially reported as intensive A1C lowering led to increased mortality in patients with coronary artery disease. However, then it was reported that the patients in the intensively treated group that actually did better, they didn't seem to have the increased mortality. But because of all these studies, and here's one in the intensive care unit, that more intensive glucose control actually caused more morbidity and mortality. So we're backing down on this. The VA study was kind of interesting. It showed that decreased risk of cardiovascular events in adults who initiated intensive glucose control in the first 15 years of diagnosis. Later on, didn't seem to help them as much. And we also have to remember that not everybody on intensive treatment has better sugars. These are insulin pumps, just another FYI. Insulin pumps aren't for everyone. You have to be motivated. I get consults all the time saying this patient's non-compliant, won't do anything. They should be on a pump. Well, a pump doesn't do everything yet. There's some pumps coming out that are getting close, but pumps don't do everything. You have to be motivated. The pumps only use rapid-acting insulin. They use insulin analogs. There's no more basal insulin when you're on a pump. Your basal rate is you get a certain amount of rapid-acting insulin units per hour, like 1 unit per hour, for instance. And a bolus is a carbohydrate ratio such as 1 unit for every 15 grams of carbs. And that's in the pump. The patient just tells the pump how many grams of carbs they're eating, what their sugar is. The pump will do the math. Okay, continuous glucose monitoring monitors the blood sugar every 5 minutes. There's a Dexcom, and there's the MiniMed. The thing on the belly is the actual monitor, and the thing on the pants is a pump. The sensor reads the pump. That was a MiniMed one. This is the G4, and there's a G5 device. This doesn't belong with any pump. It's independent, but there's several pumps that it actually communicates with, so it's basically a competitor of MiniMed. And I just put these things in here. If you ever want to figure out how much insulin a person should be on, theoretically, and how much they should be on for meals, these are formula to calculate that. Case one is a 22-year-old female, glucose 400, 3-plus urine ketones, no family history of diabetes, not overweight. Needs an insulin drip first because she has ketones and high blood sugar, then would likely need basal bolus insulin, diabetes education, medical nutrition therapy. A doctor can't do it all. We need help. We need the diabetes education department to educate the patient. Likely has positive GAD65 antibodies because they likely have type 1 diabetes. Case 2, 65-year-old female with type 2 diabetes for 4 years, has coronary artery disease, tingling, burning in the feet. At nighttime, bed sheets hurt, urine 2+ protein, A1C 9.1%, an average blood sugar of about 213 or 14. On NPH, 58 units twice daily. So likely this person, and I mentioned here that, I should mention that this is a case where a person might have a blood sugar of 160 on average in the morning, but the A1C says they're averaging much higher, so they must be high after meals or one or more meals. So likely needs to intensify the insulin by adding rapid acting insulin before one or more meals. I would personally, if they could afford it, change the NPH to basal insulin, Lantus, Levemir to Toujeo or Traceba. Diabetes education and medical nutrition therapy. Tell them about hypoglycemia. Case three is a 34-year-old I spoke about earlier with hypoglycemic symptoms, occurs 2 hours postprandial, does not awaken to eat, on oral contraceptives. We talked about this. Glucose meters might be inaccurate. Symptoms of hypoglycemia are catecholamine symptoms, not necessarily low blood sugar. Hard to get a blood sugar test when somebody's feeling ill. They're not going to run to the lab before eating. High percentage of normal people, especially females, have low sugars in a normal situation, not even considered low. If the patient is ill or has low blood pressure, then they might not perfuse their fingers, as I mentioned. If they truly have hypoglycemia, rule out reactive hypoglycemia if they're obese and have a family history of diabetes, particularly. Insulinoma has to be ruled out. Surreptitious insulin or sulfonylurea. I get 2 or 3 cases a year. It's unbelievable. Cortisol deficiency, as I mentioned, has to be ruled out. Malnutrition. Celiac disease, a big one there. Anorexia, of course. Rule out non-glucose causes of the spells, as I mentioned earlier, neurologically mediated hypotension, cardiac, neurologic, psychiatric, or just hunger, or side effect of medicines, or myeloma, mastocytosis, or pheo.